Everyone to the September edition of the ABCD GIS presentation. I'm Jeff Blossom with the Center for Geographic Analysis. And before introducing our speaker, why don't we go around the room and just tell us your name and what department or what school you're with, so everyone kind of knows where everyone's coming from. And why don't we start over here in this part of the room.
Super useful.
Sure, my name is Jan and I'm studying real estate at the GSD.
My name is Owen. I too am a MDes student in the Real Estate Built Environment Specialization at GSD, and you had me at Measuring Environmental Interaction.
So my name is Hal. I'm postdoctoral at CGA.
CJ, also GSD.
I'm June. I'm also from GSD and MDes student in technology.
Okay.
And I'm Peter James. I'm a faculty member at Harvard Medical School.
And thanks to Peter for bringing this to our attention. And Peter goes way back with the CGA, back 10, 12 years ago when he was a mainstay doing his work at the lab here. So it's great to see you back, Peter. And I would like to introduce then Garrett Millar. He's a user experience researcher and geospatial scientist. In 2016, he earned his bachelor's degree in psychology at the North Carolina State University. I think he's the first psychologist to ever present here at the ABCD GIS presentation series. He carries extensive domain knowledge in the cognitive sciences and biometric data collection. Garrett transitioned into the field of geospatial sciences in 2017. Now he's a third-year PhD student at North Carolina State Center for Geospatial Analytics, and a particular focus of his research is on using mobile sensing technologies like smartwatches to improve our understanding of how people experience their environment. So please join me in welcoming Garrett.
Hey. With that description, I don't even know if I need to give a presentation now. You kind of covered all the bases. So. That being said, thank you for coming today. And wow, I really don't have anything else to say on the title slide. Except, I'll say that we're going to be discussing like an overall theme of people and the environment, and basically how people not only interact but also experience their environment. And that interaction experience, can it be measured? If it can be measured, what can we do with it? And how can we, like, what can we learn from it? And so on and so forth. And so to do all that, I just kind of wanted to give a methodological overview, if you will, by presenting like guidelines and different tools and software and just ways of kind of exploring that concept. But first, to kind of provide a quick background, we are continuing to discover new ways to go to and from work and home and school, wherever you're commuting on a daily basis. Those routes or streets and bike paths that you take could also be, or should also be, considered as emotional maps of our commute. Because if you think of where we might consistently experience frustration, maybe particularly with traffic, or if there's a tricky intersection somewhere that you tend to kind of feel anxious about, I think questions such as these are becoming more and more important to ask, particularly because of what I've already mentioned, how we're coming up with new ways to get around our environment. And those new ways are kind of leading towards more actual experience of the environment. Like in the olden days, we were just kind of stuck in our cars, focused on the driving, but all of these more alternative modes of transportation do kind of just naturally lead to you paying more attention to your environment. Because if you're on your bike, you're going to be looking around a lot more, seeing everything from a different perspective as compared to your car. And so questions such as these are basically what we'll be asking and exploring today, and hopefully answering. If we can't answer them, I'll consider this presentation a success. So hopefully I can do that for you. And we'll particularly be talking about how mapping the locations of emotions, specifically strong emotions, can help improve our overall experience of the environment, because it can help decision makers such as city planners, urban planners, basically identify where environments inspire either calm or stress of the people that use those places in the environment. But before we get into the specifics of that, I like bringing it up back to the top, like, and asking the question of why emotions in the first place, and why would we want to even try and map them? So it's important to note how emotions really play a major role in our day-to-day lives. They really contribute to how we experience, well, perceive and experience the world around us. And we can experience a very wide range of different emotions, but they usually depend on the context or the place in which they are actually experienced. And in fact, emotions really are nothing more than a physiological response to some sort of stimulus or stimuli, and these do tend to arise from our environment. So take, for example, what's being shown now. There is a dog that's probably just trying to be friendly and say hello to this cyclist coming by his yard, but the cyclist doesn't suspect him, and so it startles him instead, and it kind of freaks him out, and you can see him kind of be a little bit stressed out following the interaction with the dog. But you can think of the dog as an external stimulus in the environment. It barks, it scares the cyclist, which is invoking a physiological response in the cyclist. And then that cyclist becomes stressed, which you can think of as an emotion following that encounter. So we need to have a look at what people not only are feeling in general, but exactly where they are feeling it, to hopefully better understand not like how we interact with our environment, but also understand and optimize our overall emotional and physical well-being. And so this apparent physiological response to a stimulus exists, but we want to be able to try and measure it. So let's quickly look at how we might do so. We look into a physiological metric, I guess you would say, called skin conductance. And I wanted to add, actually, we all know how complex emotion is. It's extremely hard to not only be able to tell what emotion you're feeling, but imagine trying to measure and extract a specific emotion someone else is feeling. Fortunately, there are physiological indicators like skin conductance, which our bodies just kind of naturally exhibit, and they can be used to infer whether or not someone is feeling an emotion. They can also tell you how strongly someone is feeling an emotion based on how strong that signal is coming in. And so to break skin conductance down step by step, your brain senses an emotion, your nervous system triggers sweat glands on your hands and feet, those hands and feet start to become wet with sweat. And as we all know, water conducts electricity. And so we can use wearable sensors that can pick up on that electric current that's sent between that water or sweat on your hands and feet. And so now that we know it can be measured, I think it's still important to ask why we would want to try mapping it. And if you just remember from earlier, the dog barking at the cyclist, they are noticeably still stressed after encountering the dog, but say that cyclist takes that same route in the future and remembers that the dog is likely to be encountered on that route again, and so the anticipation of encountering that dog, and say they're probably still not over it, they're suffering from PTSD from dog encounters, I don't know, they start to get stressed out about the anticipation of encountering that dog. And so this is shown heavily in research that people actually can start becoming stressed in the anticipation of a stressful event. And so if someone can be stressed before, during, and after experiencing a stressor in the environment, like it's extremely hard to not only identify but also locate the actual source of that stress or the actual source of that environmental stressor. And so this is kind of where traditional data and analytics and visualizations and methods kind of start to fall short. They really just can't match the needed level of spatial specificity and contextual clarity that's needed to truly and accurately examine what's causing these stress levels in people in the environment. And so I think the answer is kind of using a link between spatial data and physiological data, because they start to provide a quantitative way of understanding the deeply important context, the overall context of emotions, and the specific environmental stimuli that spark them. However, like with all scientific, or most scientific methods, they're still far from perfect. These methods and data are still far from perfect. And so it's important to understand the limitations, especially the methodological limitations that come with this. And so just real quick, first, the measurement quality and accuracy of wearable sensors really can't be compared to something like something you would experience in a laboratory setting. Remote sensors also just don't really give us much control over what's naturally residing in the environment. There could be a lot of external factors that we're not really interested in, and they could still be influencing the physiological data that we're seeing. And these are just going to naturally contain a bunch of noise and measurement errors that we're not interested in kind of examining, and they could also influence the actual data that we are interested in looking at. So it just makes overall data interpretation very difficult. But they are, of course, still extremely useful because they're very objective in comparison to handing someone a survey and asking how they might feel in a particular place. And they also allow us to get very high quality, high frequency, continuous data. And they also don't really ask much of study participants or people that are willing to wear the sensor, because just wear this bracelet for 2 hours a day or so. Sorry, I'm just skipping over the fourth one. It's not that impressive. So I'm just going to show you two different use cases where, or a project where I ended up applying these ideas and methods and worked with these kinds of data. The first is a project that was my introduction to this kind of data, actually. It was a huge learning curve, but it was also very exciting to start working with this kind of data, just because there's so many questions you can be answered, so many different things going on. And so this project was designed to study and map the stress of cyclists that were riding along a bike path in between two cities in the Netherlands. And then there is Nuenen, which is a museum designated to Vincent van Gogh. And there are both outdoor and indoor museum exhibits that we'll talk about soon. And if there's time, or if we feel like it, we can talk about what's next and what maybe these methods can do in different applications. So just quickly introduce you to the cycling project. There are three GoPro videos, first-person point of view GoPro videos that I'm going to show that were collected from the participants involved in the experiment. And so I just wanted to have you thinking about what, like, if anyone in here cycles, what this video kind of makes you feel, to pay homage to my psychology background. Would you feel comfortable taking this bike route, for example? Is there anything that you notice that, doesn't sit well with you? I mean, it seems pretty nice, like it doesn't seem like anything serious is going on. On the opposite, this path is very poorly maintained. There are cars passing by right near you at very fast paces. And then this one, in my opinion, is the best. These are all taken along the entire 2 hour bike ride in between those two cities that I just mentioned. And so this just gives you an idea of the variability that we might see in the data that we're working with in terms of stress. And to provide an overview of the project, it is, like my specific research stems from a much larger project, which is known as CHIPS, and it stands for the Cycle Highways Innovation for Smarter People, Transport, and Spatial Planning. And this spans Belgium, Germany, the Netherlands, and the UK. It is particularly interested in the infrastructure adaptation to increasing e-bike use. Because if you think about it, existing cycling infrastructure built for your manual bikes, it's not up to the standards that are required by using these very quick e-bikes. I mean, I just had it happen to me on the way over here. We had an e-bike that had like tires probably that thick, like just zoom by us. It just kind of introduces some issues that might need to be addressed. And if you think like the signs that are set up for cyclists, they're like zooming past them a lot faster, you'll probably have a much harder time reading them as well. And so to begin kind of exploring how the cycle highways might be adapted to this e-bike use, researchers at Breda University collected some data on 12 participants on the cycle track that I've mentioned, which was 18 kilometers long for a 2-hour bike ride. And like I said, the type of bike was an e-bike.
Yeah. Do you know the gender split of the 12?
Sorry?
Do you know the gender split of the 12 participants?
I'm actually not sure. I feel like it was pretty even. We haven't really been working a lot with like the demographic information, but I do want to start working with that. And thank you for asking a question, because I forgot to mention I like to keep my presentations as open as possible. So interrupt me if you'd like. If you have a question, I feel like more genuine and natural questions arise that way instead of having to wait until the end. So feel free to interrupt. And so just to quickly show what the bike path looked like, that was a particular location in the Netherlands. A little bit more information along or about the surrounding area on the bike path, and then a split into three 3D TSMs with the route still. It just gives you a sense of the elevation, which you honestly really don't need to worry about because it is in the Netherlands, which is probably flatter than a pancake. Just a 3D ortho photo of that area. I think the path is kind of along that main road right in this region. And so this kind of gives you an overview of the like data collection methods. There was a researcher that was riding along with them, wearing a 360 degree camera. They recorded notes about the cyclists, but then they also stopped them at particular places to ask them simple questions like if any specific areas were bothering them. And then on the cyclist, they had a GPS application on their phones that would record their location. And they also had a GoPro video camera, which you saw. And they also had their stress levels recorded by a wearable bracelet called an Empathic E4. Which picks up people's heart rate and skin temperature and skin conductivity, which we are specifically looking at today. And as a resulting video of that data collected, this kind of serves as a pretty good example because it has the GoPro first person point of view or video, of course, but it's overlaid with real-time updated location data, such as their direction, particular location on the route shown up in the top left, time of day, elevation gain, distance. I know it's a little bit fuzzy, I have to use a GIF. And this is like an overall speed chart of their entire route that shows their location of that speed route.
What software did you use to produce?
This was Python.
The speed track, the yellow, is that like the red is when they stopped?
Yeah, and that's probably just representative of where they were stopped by the researcher to conduct those interviews. So it serves as a good example of the data, but I also think it just raises a really interesting question that we should consider. We like to think of geospatial big data, or just big data in general, as these like world-scaled data sets or Landsat imagery of an entire country. And like, we have issues with that alone, but I think it's also extremely interesting to think of it the same way for these data sets that are only involving 12 people, because it's measured at a, for the physiological data, it's measured at a 4 hertz sampling frequency, so collected 4 times every second. The GPS location data is collected once every second, and that results in, for I think all participants, it results in about, at least in R, 800,000 rows of data that you can basically do just about anything with. I mean, seriously, it's like terabytes of data if you were to like actually build it into real data variables and not just read it in as a CSV. Basically, there is a bunch of work that someone could do with 12 cyclists' physiological and location data. And it's extremely hard to figure out what you should do with that data, which specifically brings me to
one. Just to flesh out why I asked about the gender split. So there was a TfL study when they were doing the Cycle Superhighway in London about how it seems there is a disproportionately high level of safety that female riders feel when there is a particular width of concrete barrier through an urban area. And the, whenever they were doing the focus groups on that, it seemed that for some reason female riders really responded well to just having a bit of extra support between them and the vehicle. So it was one of your three visions, so I didn't know if it came up.
Yeah, do they have theories as to why?
No.
Okay. I'll have to check that out, though. Thank you. But like I was saying, because it's so hard to figure out exactly what to do with this data because there's so many possibilities, it kind of inspired me to build one of my main applications now, which you're seeing just as a quick screenshot or a screen capture to you. It basically allows you to pick each cyclist that's in the data set, say if you're just interested in one cyclist maybe. Maybe you're interested in selecting all of them. And this honestly started as a, I was initially given the data set and I was trying to figure out exactly what to do with it. And it didn't matter like what visualization or what graph or what map, what kind of reports or analytics that I ran on the data, I feel like I still wasn't really getting a good sense of what's possible with it or what's really going on in the first place. Like I had to generate a research question in the first place, and I still couldn't even do that with my usual go-to visualizations and analyses. And so I wanted to bring all of this data into something that allows me to better explore it and allows me to better develop particular research questions and understand more about what's actually happening in the data. And so this is actually using Mapbox. The base map is built in the Mapbox platform, also coupled with some JavaScript programming. And the chart on the top right shows you like an overall skin conductance, or shows you overall skin conductance values over time. And this is dynamically loaded based on the data that is loaded in the map view frame. So every time I pan or zoom out, that chart will automatically update for you. The dots are, of course, the cyclists' locations, but those are also colored by their levels of skin conductance for you to quickly identify maybe some specific areas in the cycling track that might be evoking some either calm or very stress-inducing reactions in the cyclists. And you might have noticed that you can also click on one of the cyclists' points, which will give you further information about that particular data point. I'm hoping I click on it soon. Yeah, it tells you specific skin conductance values, their speed, elevation at that point and their distance traveled to that point, but it also automatically loads a street level first person point of view picture. And I consider this to be the most valuable part about it, because with this kind of data, you can do a lot with it. You can understand a lot about it and maybe start to infer things about the cyclists or people's mental states or emotional well-being, but you still can't like truly relate to what they were experiencing that ended up causing those physiological signals that you're seeing. And so to be able to click on a point and get an actual first-person point of view of the environment that they were encountering at the time they were exhibiting those specific levels of stress, I find that to be the most valuable tool or feature of it. And this is something that researchers in this area that work with these kind of data, which honestly is a lot, I don't blame them, or I don't blame the low numbers and researchers is like kind of sort of trying to figure out this data, because there's just so many different possibilities, it's hard to focus on some things in particular. But as I was mentioning earlier, the traditional analyses and visualizations and methods and stuff really do fall short because of how complex this data is and how many possibilities there really are with data such as this. You just can't really run your traditional statistical analyses on this and report on a particular location statistically significantly showing higher levels of stress. It just, there are too many different nuances going on in the data. And so researchers really are calling for things like this that allow for researchers to get a more close look into the moment-by-moment interactions with the environment, which can help us better infer about people's mental states as they're interacting with the environment. And I think something like this allows you to do that, but it's also still has its limitations, of course. I think there will always be limitations in this kind of data. But it at least gets closer to that view and need that urban researchers and human behaviorists are kind of calling for. I never connected to the Wi-Fi here, but you all can go to my GitHub, which is, I think, provided on the like last slide, and play around with this yourself. It's a really good way to kill time, and not speaking from personal experience there.
For skin connectivity, do you have to establish a baseline with each subject? Because, you know, some people are cool as a cucumber, yet some really get anxious over little things.
Yeah, that physiological processing is done in MATLAB, and that's actually where the linking between the location and physiological data is done as well, because as I mentioned earlier, the physiological data is sampled every 4 seconds, location data is sampled every 1 second, or once every second. So those need to be linked together, but then before that, they're actually processed in a MATLAB toolbox called LitoLab, which is specifically designed for that baseline application and correction. I think it's like a few minutes at the start of their cycling ride, at the start and end, actually.
Okay.
Which is applied to the overall data set. And then, so getting to the next project, that museum project that I was mentioning, the Vincent van Gogh Museum, the same concepts and same methods were sort of applied here, basically tracking the visitors' locations and emotional excitement while they experience both indoors and outdoor exhibits. Oh, and they were also guided through a walking tour, so they were all kind of traveling along to the same locations at the same time. Just to get a quick sense of the study location, as I said, there were both outside and indoor exhibits, so this is just showing the outdoor area, that there's 5 exhibits that are outdoors, and then there's also indoor exhibits. I think, I can't remember how many there are in the actual building, but it is 3 stories, and so like as visitors traveled up in the museum, they kind of like went along a timeline of Vincent Van Gogh's life. And maybe maybe you guys will actually know how annoying it is to try indoor mapping. Does anyone have experience with indoor mapping? I hated my life for like 2 months.
Yeah, I've seen enough presentations from people doing indoor mapping to realize it's real difficult.
Really, really, really. I mean, it's extremely exciting, really interesting, but it's probably the toughest data I've ever worked with. This was after, like I said, I don't know if I mentioned the timeline, but this was after working with the cycling data. And to give you a quick sense of like the ideal data set to kind of explore and ask the questions that we are interested in hopefully answering, for an analysis or research such as this, you would want to know which person it was, their specific locations, which should be sampled every second, the time they spent in each specific location, their associated skin conductance values, and their direction to and from exhibits, which is a very, very important variable, which I think a lot of people tend to overlook, and their velocity or speed, and their actual distance to the exhibits, as well as view sheds. Is anyone familiar with a view shed? It basically is a process that allows you to compute what someone should be seeing in their line of sight based on where they're standing. And it uses like a elevation model to determine that, which contains buildings and trees and whatnot, and the view shed is computed based on that. This just shows you the outdoor exhibits, their locations in the red icons, and then those black ants are the participants' locations, sampled over the entire tour. And I apologize because I know these are small. I created this for a paper and I didn't have time to adapt it for a presentation, but this just kind of gives you an overview of all the data, not all the data, but the main data variables, like as in how many data points were collected, people's time spent in particular locations, as well as their skin conductance values. But I think this is an important thing to note if you're initially working with this data and trying to figure out what might be going on in it, especially if you don't have access to an interactive application like the one I just showed you. You should look at it and inspect it from not only a bunch of different statistics like the mean, standard deviation, and range, but you should also scale it down and scale it up. Because if you think of the way that rasters are created, you're predefining the size of a grid cell. And every data point that was collected within that grid cell is thrown in together and aggregated together. So if you scale up that grid cell, so you go from 1 meter to 5 meters, that cell or box is bigger, and so more data is thrown into that grid cell, and that can heavily affect your outcomes. And this is the first approach that I took. I mentioned it with the list of the variables. This gives you the distance that participants were to each exhibit. The colored circles around each exhibit are just different ranges of meters, so like 10, 20, 30, 40 meters. And that just basically tells you how far away each person was to each exhibit as associated with the skin conductance level that they were experiencing. I completely forgot to mention that this museum is undergoing redesign or being considered for redesign. And so the museum director is interested in finding out which exhibits, both outdoor and indoor, should be kept based on the emotional excitement of the visitors. So I was doing this work in hopes to inform their actual redesign, if they should completely drop an exhibit or if they should even emphasize an exhibit, because it was just so exciting to the visitors.
What's the background image?
Oh, that's what I was just mentioning. It's like an elevation model So the dark blue is kind of like ground floor, whereas you can see trees here. These are buildings. That's a taller building, a really tall tree. But yeah, it's just a very high quality elevation model. Is that 0.5 meters? And these are the view sheds that I was talking about, computed for each exhibit. So if you imagine each visitor standing at each exhibit, this tells you in orange what their line of sight should be. And this analysis, the view shed analysis, also gives you pretty interesting metrics to look into based on, like, basically the like environment complexity. It tells you like how many features are in a person's line of sight. And so you can start extracting more contextual information about that environment and relate it back to the skin conductance or stress levels that your subjects are experiencing. And it's just an animated version of that. And then this one assumes the path that participants were taken on in between each outdoor exhibit, showing their line of sight along each point in that path. And so it really just starts giving you a really much better idea of really exactly what visitors are experiencing, what they're seeing, and if you can successfully relate it back to the physiological data, start to infer what they are feeling based on what they're experiencing and seeing. That's not important. For the indoor data, that caused me a lot of frustration and dread, which is pretty dangerous as a graduate student already. You already have a lot. You don't want to add to that. As I mentioned, there was three floors, and that's what's being shown to you now. But the most important thing to note is these red dots. They are showing you locations of specifically placed Bluetooth beacons on each floor. And these were used in hopes to, so we couldn't use the GPS application on participants' phones like we did with the cycling, just because indoors it starts to get, their signal starts to get really corrupted, of course. And so to circumvent that, we wanted to use beacons placed at specific locations that can determine signal strength, Bluetooth signal strength, in between participants' phones. And the specifically placed beacons. And that signal strength, which is here for each specific beacon, is shown to you. And it particularly allows you to, I actually wrote a specific function for this to predict, like based using the signal strength and the known location of the beacon, you can start to, it's called trilaterating their locations based on, like I said, signal strength and the known location. And you use it on a known relative grid. So we didn't use like your typical spatial coordinates. It had to be a relative spatial coordinate system based on the museum. And so using this,
I was just wondering a little bit more about the technology you used to map. Have you looked at anything with like current VR setups with like the HTC Vive? They use beacons in corners of rooms to kind of like set up a perimeter, and the remote controls are registered through those, the beacons that are set up in these corners, and are pretty good at logging different locations in terms of velocity, direction, and placement. Right now, I think those are pretty small because they're more for like gaming or kind of small scale experiences. But I feel like there could be a potential to like exploit that technology in a way of using them in a bigger indoor environment. You know, if you imagine these sensors on all the corners of the rooms within the gallery, if they're strong enough, then, you know, a user could be, with their ticket, some museums have, like, bracelets, like RFID bracelets or like little dongles they can carry along.
Yeah.
maybe it's just another way of gathering data or like parsing it through location and velocity to know where people are, how long they are, you know, where they're walking. Maybe it's maybe less specific and more of like a hack or an adaptation of something that's already existing.
I don't think it needs to be all that specific. As long as you can get like a general idea of where people are, like especially indoors, where people tend to feel a certain way, I think that's enough.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming here, but I feel like, well, not for the first point, but which you do make an extremely good point. I feel like two things. One, I don't think we have all that much money.
Right.
I think they're a lot more expensive than the ones we use. And two, I think I'm assuming here that those are designed for one person and not to get like a collection of multiple people, like 16 to 20 people at a time. Accurately, I could be completely wrong, but that's my assumption.
I mean, usually
I would want to look into it, though.
Usually, like a single person has the two remotes in each hand because a lot of it has to do with the virtual engagement with hands in the space. But if you think one person gets a remote and they've got it strapped into a backpack, you know, it's less about where their hand is in relationship to grabbing something or touching something, and it's more about just a node within a space.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, two remotes for one person ultimately could be like one remote for each person because it's, I don't know, maybe a little bit of a stretch, but just thinking about
I don't think it is. And I know that we're wanting to run something similar indoors in the future, so I'll definitely look into that.
And that, I mean, actually, I was just at the Rembrandt house in Amsterdam. And they have, you know, when you go in for all these different languages, you just get kind of a little thing, and you hold it up to displays you want to hear about. I mean, it would seem to be a pretty easy tool to use to get. I mean, it's all hindsight's 2020, but that seems like in the future something you could do.
Yeah, I feel like if we just gave it one more year, we would just get the most precise, like down to the inch locations of indoor. People's indoor.
I guess the only way I bring that up is kind of we just recently completed a project where we did that, where we used the HTC setup and the remotes to log data.
Mm.
Just the location of the remotes, obviously a very small
virtual location,
but thinking of how that could be applied. And
I think it definitely could. I'll have to see if anyone has applied it already, but if not, then that would be really cool to explore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you. So like I said, using the signal strength and the locations of the beacons, I was able to end up basically predicting particular participant locations within the overall museum. So as I said, there's three floors. You can see the separation there. You can also see some of them going upstairs here. So keep in mind, these are predicted, they're not definite, but you are being shown much more precise location data that can be better used to basically identify which museum exhibits you might want to keep or which ones you might just want to do away with. And these points being shown to you are, of course, colored by the participants' associated skin conductance. And so, related to the application I've already shown you, this deserves a lot more development time because I think it could be really cool. But I did want to get at least like a base application together for this as well. And it shows you that 3D model of the museum. I didn't do the third floor just because it's really no interesting exhibits up there. And I think there was like three beacons up there as well for some reason. So I didn't really get all that much precise data for the third floor, but it just gets back at my point of using these more interactive and dynamic observations and examinations of this kind of data. And so those circles being shown to you are also scaled up more and scaled more towards each specific exhibit's location, and again colored by conductance values. So these are very nice to look at and think about and kind of ask questions about, but I have a very, very strong personal philosophy as a scientist to apply it to the real world, which, I mean, these are being applied to the real world, but at the same time, they're not. They're more for my dissertation research and to be able to show people like you cool visualizations. But I really am interested in getting this actually out in the real world. And I think the real promise in doing so is the fact that so many people are wearing smartwatches nowadays. I have one on. I think you might have one on. I can't tell. Is that a smartwatch?
Yeah.
Does anyone else have one on? Anyway, my point is they're becoming... I've been really unlucky with my audiences for this topic. Like, I swear, I know so many people with smartwatches, and I only get the audiences that don't wear them. Because it really proves my point that I would hope to be able to make, that they're just becoming extremely widespread, and they can be leveraged. I mean, they can be used to basically do the exact same things that I've been showing you. Get at how people are interacting with their environment, and do so on a much, much bigger scale. And is anyone familiar with the concept of smart cities? Yeah, I think this is probably its biggest promise with smart cities. If you're constantly, overlooking data privacy issues, if you're constantly monitoring people's locations and their associated physiology, then you can really start to scale that up and get a very, very overall idea of how people actually experience and interact with their environment. And in doing so, you can build that environment in a very intelligent way, as it's best suited to the people that use it, which is by definition a smart city. Sorry, skipping over this.
Is that for in hospitals?
Oh, I have a few. Sorry, one second. Actually, that's not important. All I was going to say here is that I want to kind of... Sorry, I just have a question, actually.
No, I was just saying that you said it was important, but it looked like nursing. Were you looking at any sort of healthcare applications?
I'm hoping to very soon.
Yeah. It's not necessarily... The study that we're talking about is not necessarily healthcare relevant, though. There are nurses who are in a cohort study, so they've been like followed for years.
Yeah.
They just happen to be nurses, so we're not necessarily going to look at them within like a hospital setting. We could. I mean,
I don't want to.
Yeah, exactly. We have a lot of.
It's always stressful, just everywhere you go.
Only that, but it's indoors again, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, really we're focusing primarily on like kind of outdoor like smartphone location data.
Mm-hmm.
But we could theoretically look within the hospital.
Just thinking about ways that, you know, in terms of the prevalence of the technology that we wear, you know, like everybody's already carrying very advanced computers on their body, you know, and the smartwatches is just another edge to that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I think from my perspective, it feels like the being able to analyze heart rate is like a really big key to emotional feedback that really sets it apart from almost everything the cell phone does. So like in terms of emotional response to any sort of, you know, environment, you know, what are some of the, like, I'm curious to see how that can be put to leverage in other ways, like in a humanitarian sense and like a commercial sense, or like something that's actually deeper rooted in human experience and interaction with environment, you know?
Thank you very much for asking that, because I think this can be at least eventually applied to the increasing development of autonomous vehicles, because it kind of gets back to one of my first points about how we're seeking out these alternative modes of transportation, and in the process are kind of just naturally starting to in a more focused way interact with our environment, or at least are picking up more things about our environment. And the same thing is going to happen with autonomous vehicles. At least that's my assumption, because the higher level of autonomy in a vehicle, the more it allows you to do, and the more it allows you to experience in terms of your environment. Because if you're driving and you're not having to pay attention to the car in front of you or to the side of you or a traffic sign or whatever, you're going to start looking at your environment, you're going to start noticing things, and you're probably going to start noticing things that you don't like. Hopefully there are people out there that will notice things that they do like as well. But I think it's even more applicable for that because you can have built-in sensors on the driving wheel or in the seat. Their seat buckle, it's actually more accurate to pick up people's physiology if there's a band around their waist. So that could easily be done. You can also put in like facial gesture recognition technology in the webcam, and you can get so many different physiological data and relate it to the specific location, which will of course be being tracked in that that vehicle. And I just think that's got to be, like, I should have been doing the research on that. Not cyclists.
Autonomous vehicles. Well, I ride a motorcycle, so kind of like a counter from all those things. It's like, you know, people who are in a driverless car, you know, they've got a certain sense of leisure and they can pay attention to the environment. But when you're on a bike riding in a city, you're paying attention to everything because you have to. I'm thinking like, there's the car, but you know, you can probably put one of those things on the band of like inside of the helmet or something for
if you're comfortable measuring your butt pulses, I guess. Or just wear a bracelet. I mean, that's all that's really needed, and maybe have a GPS tracker in your motorcycle. But I mean, it's insane to think about. Like, I mean, I bike probably like half the time back home, and just thinking about my general awareness and what I actually perceive in the environment, the differences in between biking and driving my car is just insane.
Why haven't there been? I mean, you see the bicycle studies quite a bit, but has there been much with sensors on drivers? Because, you know, there's, at least in this country, overwhelming majority of working adults drive.
Yeah.
Still, and I would think city planners and, you know, there would be an interest in figuring out when and where people are stressed and, you know, and then compare, like, to a bike ride.
Yeah.
Does the benefit of exercise and fresh air, you know, how much does that relax people?
I think the application will always be there. I think it doesn't really matter. I mean, it does kind of matter what, how we're actually exploring these methods. But I think overall, it really doesn't. I think just the general ideas that I've shown they can be explored in any scope, pretty much. And they can be related to, in the future, like autonomous vehicles. At least I believe. I think we need to spend time as researchers basically figuring out how this data should be examined and what it can really tell us, and then it can be applied to the larger scale applications. At least I could be wrong there, but I think that's accurate. And I honestly, like, to be completely frank, I needed a data set for a class project, and I had connections to Experience Lab people in the Netherlands who sent me the cyclist data, and to them, cycling is driving. So I think there's a lot more push for that on the cyclists and over in Europe and particularly the Netherlands, but I do truly believe it can be applied to things that better relate to Americans, like driving.
Have you thought of any sort of, I'm curious about the ideas of controlling, protecting, and distributing this data for whatever resources. Have you at all speculated on potential misuse apart from just practical use? You know, there's, you know, with larger companies like Facebook and Amazon, they're making efforts to distinguish personality. And so you think about understanding personality profiles and this addition of another layer of emotional profiles, you think it would be useful to be put into a bigger picture of a collective group of data with the individual user, or by itself as just the emotion? I think if you layered on top of all the other data you're getting from people, it would build even stronger profiles of understanding their lives and what they do in the actual, you know, locations in which these stressor moments happen. Do you see that at all kind of overlapping with pre-existing data models that people are gathering on civilians or users, or do you kind of see it being isolated as just the heart rate and emotional response?
It's a very important philosophical question that's been arising especially recently, but it's also, I think, been around for about, I don't know, at least like the past decade or so.
Mm-hmm.
I do think, personally, to wear my tinfoil hat, I think Facebook and the bigger companies like Google, I think they're already doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Especially for like personality profiles,
yeah,
or person profiles. And so I don't think it's like as intrusive as it could be. It really depends on how we use it and
right,
our own personal beliefs as people in the environment, and maybe just we'll end up boiling down to the sacrifice that we're willing to give to our privacy to better our lives overall in our environment. And I still think there are probably some methods that can be explored and developed that
right,
do still kind of help protect against the more maybe personal features of that data. But I mean, it's a question that just keeps arising more and more nowadays, and I think it should still be, just continue to be asked so that people are actually aware of it and people can actually do something about it. But
mm-hmm,
I think it will end up just coming down to people's willing to sacrifice their privacy.
Yeah, how they use it or how they actually use the data, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we all have cell phones already. If people really wanted to, they could hack into the webcam or phone cam and pick up your personal gestures, I mean, your facial gestures, and analyze based on that.
Yeah.
There's so many things that could be done. It's a matter of whether they're doing it or not,
mm-hmm,
in the first place, and what we're comfortable with, basically. But I mean, it's probably one of the most interesting questions to
mm-hmm,
ask when it comes to this kind of research.
Because I could imagine it being very valuable to companies like that if the technology gets developed. You know?
Yeah. Sacrifice for the greater good, I guess.
Yeah. Right.
Well, we are assuming that the galvanic skin response is like a valid response that we know what it makes sense of, right?
Yeah.
And that's something we touched to. Gary gave a talk at the School of Public Health earlier today, and I think there was a little more exploration of what the meaning of skin response, I mean, sweating, basically, right? I mean, that's what it comes down to. And you could have a positive reason that you're sweating or a negative reason that you're sweating, and can we disentangle what that is? I don't know that we're there yet. I mean, it may be another, you know, yet another data stream that you could use to build an algorithm to predict some sort of, you know, personality type, or, you know, basically learn how to sell somebody something. You know, this type of person will vote this way or will buy this thing. You know, you come at them a certain way. So I certainly see it could be some sort of meaning, but we don't necessarily, you know, it's not a gold standard measure of emotion just yet. I mean, there's a few other than self-report.
Yeah.
So I think there's still more work to be done. I don't think that it's like if, you know, Google gets access to this.
I don't even know if it can ever be developed. I mean, like, emotion is one of the most complex, like, phenomenon that I've probably ever personally learned about. Like, it's extremely hard for yourself to be able to tell what emotion you're actually experiencing, let alone be able to infer that based on these wonky numbers that you're trying to work with. I mean, yeah, there's still a lot to go in terms of actually being able to tell someone's specific emotion, and that's under the assumption that that point is actually reached at some point.
Yeah.
Question, comment. I thought that your use of the video with the information was like, it was really great to see that. It was just, there's so much, by just watching that, there's so many factors happening, and you can kind of, it really helps to watch the video moving through space and to watch the graph right next to it and just kind of connect the dots.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was really persuasive use of technology to get this data across. And then the app that you created, that's also really fabulous about interrogating that. So I was really into the representation that you built out of the data that you were provided. What my question is as I watched the video of, like, let's say a cyclist moving towards the roundabout, what I perceive to be a roundabout or the bumpy road, I actually could feel inside my heart rate increase as I watched it, because I've been cycling really for the first time to get around in Cambridge, and I've been experiencing many emotions.
See, you're the type of person that needs to be wearing a smartwatch.
That's right. And so, okay, so if an image can elicit that kind of response to me, in me, then if I look at a picture of broccoli, is that going to elicit a different response if I actually see broccoli? If I look at a picture of steak versus, you know, an actual steak, you know, maybe I'll get more hungry, more excited, perspire, you know, or a roller coaster. And so where I'm going with this is that how sensitive is your is this device? Is it picking up minute changes in my perspiration? Or do I have to be truly shocked by, like, somebody jumping up from behind me, me producing sweat, which I can feel it evaporate off of me? Is that what's the level of sensitivity, do you think, that we're playing with here?
It's definitely, I think, as specific as you would need, but it also introduces its own challenges in that, because like being able to pick up very small changes, although someone might be able to deem those important, it's really not important for inferring actual behavior and actual emotion. And so it kind of introduces a lot of noise amongst the signal that you're actually interested in. I mean, it does, like for four times every second, you should imagine that that's pretty specific, and probably as specific as you need to. But I still personally don't trust much of the data that I look at on a day-to-day basis. There's a reason I didn't present my statistical results to you, because I just don't believe them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think the main reason that I did develop that application is because it starts to get at the bigger picture, which I think is the more important thing to examine, is the bigger picture, and not really bog yourself too much down in the weeds of the very very small scale nuances of human physiology. I think it's just a very complex thing that it might not really be all that important to really examine, unless you're conducting a study that actually needs to look at those minutiae.
Mm-hmm.
And I also forgot to mention with my application, I mentioned limitations, but I didn't really describe them. You need to think about someone, one of the participants that the data was collected on. We still don't know, the state of, the weather, or, how bright the sun was that day, how cloudy it was, how dense the traffic was at that time. That was done in the hopes that it can be applied to other people's data sets that contain people's location and physiology. And so it was really automated and scaled up. But there's, even with something that's providing you with such a more close look into that data, it's still technically not enough. And so that's why I'm kind of bringing up the point of not really being too worried about those minutia. I think to be able to continue to scale it up as much as possible and look at the bigger picture as accurately as you can should be the goal.
Yeah, with your video, it allows post-processing, and you can classify things like sunshine and wet streets.
Yeah.
And I mean,
yeah, you still can.
As a cyclist, that's one of the things that get.
Yeah.
My heart rate racing is.
Yeah, was
wet.
Was yours a little bit raising the third video? Because that was a wet road. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah, a little bit. and yeah, any kind of wet pavement or, puddles, certainly
mm-hmm.
ice, right? Those kinds of things. So this huge grab of data is the start.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then things get really.
And we're at the very, very start of the start.
And do you know what kind of GPS receivers they were using?
It was a mobile application on their phone.
So it was their phone GPS.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So then, building on that, and I think the point earlier is maybe you should train a deep learning algorithm using the kind of outcome. The annotation is the galvanic skin response, right? And then you can see if it'll pick up on things like wet roads or sunshine. I don't know if you know. You could do on be agnostic,
mm-hmm.
and just let the algorithm predict what features in those images are predictive of higher or lower galvanic skin response.
Yeah, I think honestly that's like one of my main assumptions and predictions as to where this research will go. I always kind of try avoiding bringing it up though, because it just opens up this like whole can of worms on if we can automatically and mechanically predict human behavior and make decisions from it. But I think that's kind of where this has to go, because the data is so big, there are so many variables and nuances going on within the data that really just don't allow us, like we're just not capable as humans to examine our own behavior. It's insane with how much is going on and how much is really, really, really tough to classify, or it's not even classifiable in the first place.
Yeah. But playing devil's advocate, maybe it actually, in the end, is super simple, right? I mean, it's things that people...
You just insulted all of us.
No. But I mean, it's what was said earlier, is that like you see an intersection and your heart rate goes up. You know, I mean, that's... It may be that, you know, we could do... You know, I propose this fancy machine learning algorithm just to a straw man to say, well, if we know it's wet roads and it's intersections and things that we kind of associate with being a little bit more dangerous, right? Well, you know, I think maybe we try and address those things. I mean, this would be confirmatory. I would say, yes, we are right. Like, your skin response does go up for those things. And so maybe this measure is kind of capturing that. But really what we care about is what is the kind of actionable item, right? Like, have we identified the things that provoke stress in us, and can we modify them to decrease that, right? That's the ultimate. I mean, forgive me if I'm wrong, but
no, I mean, I think you're dead on, and I think like it's also, I feel like it's also, it could be also important or interesting to look into like the recovery of a known and uncontrollable stressor. Like, say there's something in the environment or in the city that's just like, it just makes everyone stressed out, but there's no one anything can do about it. And so you could even start like, I don't know, predicting or figuring out what might be able to allow people to recover that, and then develop the environment based on that. I feel like I could go anywhere with this, anyone really could, and I think we just need to keep asking the questions that we are asking.
Have you zeroed in on a dissertation topic? I mean, right? Because it seems like there's so...
You sound like my dad. No, as the simple answer. I think I'll probably end up with kind of developing and evaluating these types of software systems or visualizations, whatever you call them, as a way to visualize and inform, well, visualize visual data for informing decision making. I think that's probably what I'll end up going with. Because I even have I already have an established chapter that was looking at if people learn better from tangible user interfaces in comparison to traditional learning methods. That's kind of the sore thumb right now, and I don't know how to fit that in because I have a lot of work done on this research now.
Garrett, can I just ask one selfish question? For those of us who are looking at sensor research in different ways, I'm just curious about the economics of doing this. So let's say I wanted to do research that required 30 to 50 sensors to be put in certain locations to test the viability of something. How have you found the economics of doing this? Like, just literally, how much does it cost?
Peter might be the better one to answer that, actually.
Well, it depends on what you mean. Which sensors?
Like a Fitbit, maybe?
This would be less on people and more on environmental conditions on, say, the outside building.
So like maybe like weather sensors or something.
Yeah.
I know they can get, I don't know much, but I know they can get pricey, I guess, like 30 or 60 weather sensors. Does your program tend to receive a lot of funding?
Sorry?
Does your program tend to receive a lot of funding?
Question.
So, City of Cambridge, the GIS administrator there would maybe have some insight to that.
Yeah, I can't say much about that.
Because this city is wired with all kinds of sensors.
And it depends on what sensors, what you want to measure. Mm-hmm. I mean, people at the School of Public Health could tell you all about air pollution measures. We're doing some noise measures too.
Mm-hmm.
But it really, I mean, traffic counts. I know the Regional Planning Agency does a lot of traffic counts. I don't know if that's what you're interested in.
Yeah.
But there's lots, I mean, lots of different sensors that are out everywhere, and they have very different price points.
Yeah,
because
if you go from like sound, just like down here, to atmospheric matter, like particulate matter.
Particulate matter's
way up there. So, I mean, do you know what you would want to measure?
I mean, the idea that's just generally kicking, I feel like, to your smart cities point, I feel like we just went to the political aspects of smart cities far too quickly and focused on privacy when it feels like there's still so many ways we could capture a lot more information that doesn't impinge on people's privacy at all. And some of the ideas we're thinking about are ways that exterior facades of buildings could be retrofitted to offer the city, the region, the landlord a lot more information about their nearby environment.
Mm.
And just this experience of the GPS data you've been collecting, it's just got me thinking about that. So
yeah.
And I obviously grew up, like all of us, with Twister, just thinking you could throw it on the back of a truck and it goes up into a... I've clearly shown my age there.
Yeah, no,
like,
yeah.
Got Twister. That's one of my favorite movies.
I went on a Universal ride a couple years ago.
I forgot what I was going to say. I have a colleague that, I don't know if this can relate, but I have a colleague that did kind of something similar to my research, but she was using publicly placed cameras, and uses computer vision to record overall activity of the people that are going to these public spaces, like an urban plaza or something. She was actually really able to develop some really cool visualizations, like I don't know if anyone knows what a space-time cube is. Actually, what was being shown, I can't pull it up.
Yeah.
It was being, the intestines. The friendly intestines.
That's pretty interesting. Was that in the U.S. or in?
That was one of the cyclists' data, just 3D mapped over location and overall time, which is about 3,000 seconds for 2 hours.
In terms of the application in public space.
I think it was done over morning, afternoon, and night, and so that space-time cube that was. More ends up looking like an intestine that needs to be released, I guess.
Yeah.
It was colored by time of day, and so there was like three different colors, and the density showed the overall people density, the volume showed people's density. I could provide anyone with that name if they were interested. Anna Petrosova, she's at the CGA as well. NC State with them. And so basically, what I hope to be able to show you today is how linking spatial data with behavioral data kind of allows us to at least begin, as we've talked about and identified, to contextualize and start to understand how people really start to interact, or how they interact and behave in their environment. I think it's a very valuable type of investigation to conduct. And with that, thank you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
I do technically have